Hello there, this is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, and on behalf of the entire team, we hope you enjoy the program. This is the Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. This hour, a look at the pain of waiting for that phone to ring. The poignant rituals of long-distance lovers, more and more two-income households, put partners in different states or even different countries. Anna Sale, host of the Death, Sex, and Money podcast, takes on the separation anxiety of commuter marriages later this hour. Also, we'll have a look at how some low-tech innovation makes useful artificial limbs for the developing world. We will have updates on the violence in Nigeria and an energy deal between China and Russia that just might be a $400 billion sidestep around Western sanctions. But first, drawing the line on climate change and federal environmental regulations. In a moment, we'll learn how Wyoming lawmakers think teaching the settled science of climate change is inappropriate for school kids. But first, Oklahoma's love affair with carbon has put that state at odds with President Obama on regulating carbon emissions from power plants.
Today, about 40% of America's carbon pollution comes from our power plants. But here's the thing. Right now, there are no federal limits to the amount of carbon pollution that those plants can pump into our air. None. Zero. We limit the amount of toxic chemicals like mercury and sulfur and arsenic in our air or our water, but power plants can still dump unlimited amounts of carbon pollution into the air for free. That's not right, that's not safe, and it needs to stop.
Since the president outlined his intentions in a speech nearly a year ago, he has instructed the Environmental Protection Agency to issue new regulations on power plant emissions and carbon by June 2nd. The Supreme Court has said the EPA has this authority, but the state of Oklahoma says no. The EPA has no such authority to impose limits state by state or even power plant by power plant. Joining us now is Oklahoma's Attorney General Scott Pruitt. Welcome.
Thank you.
Hasn't the Supreme Court given the president a specific authority and the EPA specific authority on this already?
Well, Massachusetts versus EPA was a case that stands for the proposition that CO2 is a hazardous air pollutant under the Clean Air Act. But that is as far as it went. As it related to non-stationary sources, what the president's talking about presently is stationary existing sources, power plants that make up about 40% supposedly of carbon emissions in this country. And the Clean Air Act is not clear, honestly, on how to deal with that. And so our Oklahoma plan is a proposal to the EPA as they are considering rulemaking. As you know, the president has instructed the EPA to publish rules, I think, on the June 2nd of this year. And this is a proposal to the EPA almost in the form of a comment as they do their rulemaking on how they should do it properly, consistent with the Clean Air Act.
Now, people who may live in Tennessee, are going to feel the effects of emissions that come from power plants in Oklahoma. Why isn't that a federal concern?
Well, I don't think Oklahoma has said that it isn't a concern, John. I think that obviously the EPA has served a very historical, important role as far as regulating air quality that obviously crosses state borders. That is an important role for them to perform, but they have to do so consistently with the laws as outlined by Congress. And as you look at Section 111D of the Clean Air Act, it clearly says the states have primacy in establishing the plan, the standards, if you will, on a unit-by-unit basis. It does not give the EPA the authority to engage in a cap-and-trade approach where it sets the emission standards on a state-by-state basis. That takes away discretion away from the states as outlined by Congress. This is a rule of law matter, John. It isn't about necessarily whether this is something we ought to be looking at as states or as the EPA. What matters is that as it's done so consistent with the laws as passed by Congress.
Let's take a look at the logic of what the president said a year ago. Is it the case that the EPA is clear on federal regulations of mercury and sulfur and arsenic, but not clear on carbon?
I think that because this is a judicial enactment, if you will, that CO2 is considered a hazardous air pollutant, and you look at existing stationary sources, it is a very fundamental question on how you do that. Perhaps the weather has been determined whether you should regulate CO2, although I think that's going to be contested by many. I think the how is the focus of the Oklahoma plan.
So if the feds come up with standards, you just want your own ability to meet those standards. You don't necessarily...
The feds have the authority under the Clean Air Act to establish guidelines for the states to adopt standards. That is how the Clean Air Act speaks to this issue. The EPA does not have the authority to establish the standards and impose them upon the states. The states have authority under the Clean Air Act to engage in cost-benefit analyses to determine the best way to achieve the standards that they determine on a unit-by-unit basis.
But doesn't that get you into the business of saying, as a state of Oklahoma, we think it's okay because of our cost-benefit analysis to put this much pollution that's going to end up in states to the east?
Well, I would ask you, John, that's what the Clean Air Act says. So are we supposed to disregard what the Clean Air Act says, the language of the statute itself? The statute says that the state of Oklahoma and every state in the country can determine that less stringent standards are applicable for their power plants
for existing
stationary sources. Yeah, if that is a problem, it needs to be addressed by Congress, not the EPA. The Climate Action Plan that's been published by the president is not force of law. It is a plan that has emanated from the White House. It's not passed Congress. It's not been signed into law by the president. This issue is an important issue. The EPA has a role. Their role is to establish guidelines for the states to follow in establishing standards. If the EPA and the president and Congress wants to change that, they have a way to do that.
Okay, but and I don't want to debate you about this.
Well, you are.
Well, no. I just want to know what's the goal here? Is the goal to clean the air, or is the goal to make an issue about federalism?
Are they somehow incongruent from your perspective? I mean, I think that what you are saying is that the EPA in Washington, D.C. cares more about the air than the state of Oklahoma or the state of Tennessee or the state of Georgia. And we breathe the air in Oklahoma, not New Yorkers and not the folks in California. We care about the quality of our water and care about the quality of our air, and we balance the factors on industry and consumers. And guess who pays for all this cost, this capital cost of adding control measures at each of these units? Ratepayers, consumers. I don't see those issues of federalism and clean air as being incongruent. The environmental statutes have always recognized the importance of the states in this process. In fact, more so than any laws passed by Congress,
understood.
Cooperative federalism is the focus.
I understand, Attorney General. Where does it go from here? You said you're going to make a comment on the rulemaking, but can you take this into court?
I think our proposal speaks for itself, John. I think that it recognizes the authority of the EPA, and it recognizes the authority of the states to engage in a cooperative effort to ensure that standards are established on a unit-by-unit, inside-the-fence approach as opposed to a capitated cap-and-trade approach by the federal government on a state-by-state basis.
Attorney General Scott Pruitt, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Scott Pruitt is the Attorney General of the state of Oklahoma, challenging EPA authority in regulating power plant emissions. This is The Takeaway. Controversy over environmental policy in the state of Wyoming may affect what is taught to science students in the public schools. The next generation science standards, federal guidelines for science education, have been implemented in 11 states as well as the District of Columbia. But in March, Wyoming became the first state to officially reject the federal guidelines. State lawmakers passed a footnote to the budget prohibiting any public spending to implement the new standards. The issue is what the science standards say about human-caused climate change. Bob Beck has been covering this for Wyoming Public Media. Bob, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
What is the issue here? How does politics make its way into the classroom?
Well, it probably has more to do about a couple of people's reelection campaign. They are in some conservative districts. They made their constituents angry by removing our state superintendent from her position. They stick a conservative amendment in there to try and gain favor with some local voters. And that's kind of where we stand. This is an amendment that nobody thought would go very far, and here we are. We've held up the standards.
And here's the governor speaking about this.
I think that the legislature has, as I do, faith that the Board of Education will be able to set whatever standards, hopefully high standards, and I think that they felt more concerned that they would be stuck with standards that is not acceptable to the board or acceptable to a citizen of Wyoming.
Wyoming Governor Matt Mead talking about hopefully high standards, that seems a little lukewarm.
I think we're all playing a lot of politics here right now. John, one of the things that you should probably know is that the State Board of Education had been working on these standards for a couple of years. They had a committee that had been working on it. They almost passed them back in October, but they delayed because they wanted to, you know, still work out some things and have a chance to digest some things, and then lo and behold, this amendment comes up. They almost tried to pass the standards anyway, but I guess the governor's office told them that it would be dead on arrival. So they went ahead and decided to delay things. They're going to relook at it. It's kind of funny, though. I would almost suspect that after the election, you might see 99.5% of these standards adopted.
You know, Bob, why can't they teach the science of climate change, which is pretty settled, and also note the sensitivity that some legislators rightly have about the possible loss of jobs in the energy-rich state of Wyoming?
Well, in fact, I think they can. And I think that's probably what will happen, is they'll just redraft that portion of it, and it will come back. And again, we're talking about standards. We're not talking about what is actually being taught in a classroom. It's just what you have to, you know, certainly meet in order to graduate and to succeed in school. So it doesn't make the state look very good, that's for sure.
Whose election rides on this? Is it a local legislature or is it the governor himself?
Well, the governor, you know, they all get paranoid. He'll win easily, but they all get very paranoid out here when election time comes near. And he's been actually censured by a couple of county Republican parties because of his actions towards Superintendent Hill. But the biggest person is the House Education Chairman, a guy by the name of Matt Teeters, and he's the one that stuck the amendment on there. And he really is going to be in a very difficult primary.
And students this fall needn't worry, or will there be new textbooks by the fall? Is it going to get that far?
It won't get that far. You know, I don't know if anybody's going to be out there blacking out anything about climate change. But, you know, the thing is that you're going to see that we have local control in our state. We have people who, you know, will local school boards who will talk about what will be taught in the classroom. And so no matter what the state standards are, you would think that they'll be adjusted district by district. It's an interesting place.
So the big black Sharpies are going to stay in the drawer for the time being.
For the time being.
Bob Beck, news director of Wyoming Public Media, on standards for science delayed in the state of Wyoming. Thanks, Bob.
Thank you, John.
So if pressure is bearing down on your oil and gas revenue from Western sanctions and Western buyers of energy, what do? You look east and try to make a deal to give you a secure supply of cash no matter what sanctions come down. Russia and China are said to be making a $400 billion deal that would ensure a 30-year supply of natural gas to China from the world's biggest supplier of gas, Russia. The deal has been 10 years in the making. Joining us now, Kimberly Martin, political science professor at Barnard College, Columbia University. Welcome.
Thank you, John, for having me back.
So always great to talk to you. I'm wondering, is there any evidence that this deal was hurried up as the Ukraine crisis developed?
Well, you know, we've been watching the negotiations on this take place over many, many years, and it had originally looked like it might have been signed a year ago. The original plans had been that last June at a big international conference in St. Petersburg, it would be signed. And the evidence that we have, it's kind of hard to tell because not all of it has been made public, but it looks like what happened is that Russia caved on the price and was willing to meet the requirements that China had that had been delaying the deal up until now.
So the Chinese had some leverage knowing that the Russians really needed to make this deal.
Yes. I mean, China is obviously desperate to get raw materials at this point and all kinds of natural resources. But they have a very similar pricing deal with, as far as we can tell, a similar pricing deal with Turkmenistan. And what it looks like happened is that Russia is now willing to pay the lower rate or to accept the lower rate that China pays to Turkmenistan for its gas, which is significantly less than the price that Russia has been getting from Europe for its gas.
Now, one of the things that China has in abundance is dollars. And I'm wondering if this is essentially the, you know, Saudi Arabia of hard currency for Vladimir Putin, and if this softens the effect, significantly softens the effect of sanctions, which are aimed at trying to restrict his access to hard currency.
Well, I'm sure that that's part of it, but even more than that, Gazprom, which is the big state-owned natural gas company, has had in the works the idea for this pipeline for a number of years. Putin ordered the construction of it to start back in 2012, I believe, and the problem was that they weren't sure what the end market was going to be, because all they knew for sure is that there'd be a liquid natural gas terminal that would probably ship things to Japan. But liquid natural gas, the, you know, the prices are changing on the global market, but it's still not quite competitive in pricing with gas that's just shipped normally by pipeline. And so this also is a way of allowing Gazprom to get the funds to build this very expensive pipeline. I think some oil, gas industry sources say it's going to be the most expensive pipeline ever built. Gives them some maybe low-cost financing to build the pipeline that they weren't sure was going to be successful. And so it's really Russian state interests and the cronies closest to Putin that are benefiting the most.
So does this change the game in the infrastructure in Europe and Asia? I mean, if you look at the map of Europe, you see all those gas pipelines going through Ukraine, out of Russia, across Belarus, into Europe to supply Germany. There's been a lot of talk of supplying the Baltics and Western Europe with other sources, even United States sources, from liquid natural gas terminals that would be built in that case. Do we see in 10 years most of the gas in Russia going to Asia rather than Europe?
The gas from Russia is going to be coming from various sources, and it's all ultimately going to depend on what the interconnecting pipelines are, because the gas that's right now immediately scheduled to be, you know, in maybe 3 years to start going to China from this pipeline is going to be coming from the far northeastern area of Russia. And so it wouldn't be the same gas fields that are immediately connected to the gas pipelines that go to Europe. But one thing to keep in mind about gas pipelines is that once they're there, they're expensive to move or change. And so once you have a relationship that's set up by a pipeline, it isn't easy to undo that relationship. And, you know, the gas market right now is in incredible flux because of what's happening with the scarce gas resources that are coming online from shale gas. We don't know what's going to happen with the prices of LNG. The one thing that does seem to be happening is that prices are now more geared towards spot markets and less towards their previous dependence on oil market prices. So I think it's a situation where it's very much in the interest of Putin to try to get as many customers for the state natural gas company Gazprom as he can, given the fluctuations of market and given the uncertainty that everybody's facing.
Stepping away from the Ukraine crisis, do you think this is a stabilizing move in the sense that it reduces competition, increases availability for fossil fuels? Certainly China is going to be a competitor for fossil fuels over the next 50 years.
I'm not sure that this one pipeline has all that big an impact. It's still several years away. But everything that is happening in the oil and gas market is, I think, largely has been disturbed by what's happening in the last couple of years. And gas has never been, up until this point, a globally traded commodity. It's always been based on bilateral negotiations. And that may be changing with LNG coming online and with shale gas making LNG cheaper in the future. But at the moment, I think the most important thing is that this is just a way of really salvaging Russian state interests at a time of uncertainty because of what's going on in Europe.
And at a time when Russia is the largest supplier of natural gas and by far the nation with the largest proven reserves of natural gas.
And a very strong interest, therefore, in getting rid of some of it and finding markets for it.
Exactly. Kimberly Martin, political science professor at Barnard College, Columbia University. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Later this hour, the difficulties of making a long-distance relationship work.
My name is Sarah Shulak. I'm calling from Miami, Florida. I was in a long-distance relationship for about a year and a half, and it seemed that the only thing that kept us together when we were apart was the expectations and the idea of what the relationship could be. But as soon as we lived in the same city, it just ended.
Oh, that is such a sad story, Sarah. Oh, for heaven's sakes, what's your experience with long-distance relationships? You can call our number at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We got this story from Atlanta, Georgia. My partner and I met via friends when I lived in San Diego, and he was at college in Orlando. 18 months of daily calls, texts, seasonal visits or vacation, and a healthy dose of common interests. I moved to be with him in Orlando in 2011. He just graduated, and we are planning to return to San Diego together. Back together again. Well, let's not end up like what happened to Sarah, right? Our number is 877-8-MY-TAKE, long-distance relationships. We'll hear your stories and from Anna Seo later this hour.
Support Support for The Takeaway comes from Reputation.com, encouraging everyone to check their online search results because search results define you or your business. Learn more at Reputation.com.
Getting happy in Tehran can get you in trouble with the mullahs. Earlier this week, six young Iranians were arrested for dancing to Pharrell Williams' song, Happy, and posting it on YouTube. Part of their punishment was to go on state television to apologize and repent in another viral video with no music and no dancing. Iranian authorities are pushing back on a global phenomenon. Homemade videos set to the song Happy have been recorded in more than 140 countries. Pharrell Williams tweeted this in response to the arrest of the Iranians. It's beyond sad these kids were arrested for trying to spread happiness. Joining us now is Golnaz Esfandiari, correspondent for Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. She covers Iran and is also an editor of the Persian Letters blog. Golnaz, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Is that correct? These people were arrested for trying to spread happiness? That's Pharrell Williams' analysis.
Absolutely, that's true. They were trying to have fun, and they said, those who produced the video, that they were trying to give another picture of Iran, that Iran is not such a horrible place to live in. And yes, they were arrested. There were some reports today that some of them were released on bail.
Now, the Ayatollah who's behind this sanctioning of the video is apparently Ayatollah Marakem Shirazi. And he's quoted as saying, Islam is against laughing loudly for no reason. I have to say that if you want people to laugh loudly for no reason, just put out a rule like that.
You know, I'm not surprised that Ayatollah Makarem Shirazi said that. I remember the founder of the Islamic Republic, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, was quoted as saying that there are no jokes in Islam, there's no humor in Islam, there's no fun in Islam. And I think this has been one of the principle of the Islamic Republic, that people are not supposed to have fun. The reason that has been cited in the past 35 years or more is often religion. But another aspect of it, I think it is because of the, it goes against the authoritarian nature of the Islamic Republic. You know, they want the people to have discipline, and laughing and having fun is going against that.
Do we have any way of knowing what President Rouhani might think about this? I mean, this is exactly the opposite view of Iran that he's been trying to project.
President Rouhani has not expressed himself. He's outside of Iran. Currently, he's traveling. He's in China. There was a tweet from his Twitter account saying that it's people's right to be happy and that we shouldn't be too hard on behaviors caused by joy. This is probably a comment from his earlier speeches that was tweeted today. But let's not forget, President Rouhani is part of this system. He's been part of this system for the past 35 years. So he probably agrees with some of these things that have been happening in this country.
Golnaz, have you ever found yourself, you know, in a situation where you're laughing too hard and you look around you and worry that someone's going to drag you into jail?
Yes, I grew up in Iran, and, you know, I was warned by the moral police a number of times because I was laughing too hard in public, you know, that I'm being obscene or vulgar. And I spent one night in jail because I was arrested with my friends at a party. It's very normal. You know, it happens all the time. Nowadays, there are less arrests, more it's they fine you, so you pay and they let you get by. But in the early years of the revolution, you know, they would raid the parties, arrest people, put them in jail, and lash. One of my friends was lashed 25 times just because he was at this party with me.
Golnaz Esfandiari is a correspondent for Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. She covers Iran, is also an editor for the Persian Letters blog. Thanks so much, Golnaz.
Thank you, John.
When the wounded soldiers began coming home from the battlefields of Iraq and Afghanistan, it became immediately clear that while advanced medical technology was saving lives, prosthetic technology was still stuck in the dark ages. The federal government made significant investments in the development of advanced artificial legs and arms, and those investments are beginning to pay off. An advanced modular arm was announced last week. There are numerous robotic legs available, but these expensive high-tech breakthroughs are of no help to the millions of amputees in the developing world. As part of its mission to bring engineering to bear on the problems of poor countries, the American Society for Mechanical Engineers awarded first prize to a low-tech, low-cost prosthetic design targeted specifically for the developing world. The winner is NonSpec, a startup company formed by students at the University of Massachusetts. We spoke with Jonathan Perez de Alderete and Aaron Keeney.
The device that we have actually undercuts the cost of the average prosthetic by tenfold, and that actually allows financially 80% of the amputees to have access to our product.
And why would it be that the developing world would get your product, whereas the the industrialized world can have customized prosthetics? We've seen since the Iraq and Afghanistan wars all these, you know, robotic legs and runners. Oscar Pistorius is called the Blade Runner. Is there a disparity between what the developed world gets in the case of an amputation and what the industrialized world gets?
Very much so. And I think part of the problem with that is actually the fact that the cost for those limbs is incredibly, incredibly high. A prosthetic leg can range from $15,000 to several hundred thousand dollars, depending on the quality of the limb you're looking at. And so if you're looking at someone like Blade Runner, the cost of his limbs is just completely out of the reach of the normal person. And so it's really a challenge to get your material cost down, get your design cost down, and really make your device mass producible so we can even get a volume cost down.
And it's really making sure that we meet the needs of the areas that this will be in. So taking in electricity considerations and cultural considerations has been a big part of this.
How do you design something that will work as an arm and an elbow and a leg and a knee?
So the forearm and the upper arm and the thigh and the lower part of the leg are pretty much the same components. We can change the angle with different plates, and that adjusts with the size. But the body is pretty...
It's pretty uniform in how things behave. The elbow and the knee are different components, and so they behave in a – depending on how you need them, we've got a cam-tracking knee and a locking elbow is what we call them. So those actually do get swapped out depending on what the person needs.
And for the hand, what kinds of a mechanism are you using so that people can grasp or hold or manipulate things?
When we designed the hand, we designed it as a platform. So inside the hand, there's a hollow space, and that hollow space can either be wired with motors for people who want and have access to an electric system. For people who can't afford that or don't want that, they can get a cable-driven system, and so you swap out the motors with a special cartridge. And then for little kids who the cable system's not quite what they need, we have a ratchet system, so it's basically just some meshed gears that they can position the hand themselves with their other hand early on. So you get the functionality you want based on either how much you're willing to pay or what you need in your life, more so than just having one fixed base.
And for adults, I mean, you could actually swap out a whole different set of prosthetics way beyond simple hand imitation. I mean, you could put a power drill on there.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We encourage that, actually. I mean, really kind of when you're looking at people, it's silly to stay in one space and be like, well, it has to be this. It's just a matter of you can do whatever you want now. And so that it's really kind of an open
having
platform.
Having that universal device that lets everybody do what they want to do.
Yeah.
And our key with the hand was to offer a base package that has that human shape and human motion that puts everyone back at ease with their device.
Can you manufacture this very easily anywhere in the world? Does it require very specialized manufacturing techniques?
Not at all. If we wanted to mass produce, you're looking at – you would need access to an injection molding machine. And so to take consideration to that, we actually designed the whole thing to pack flat. So we can actually ship a kit anywhere in the world who needs it. And it's about a 4-inch by 4-inch by 6-inch package. It's a very small package, and that holds the entire limb.
Jonathan and Aaron, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Aaron Keeney and Jonathan Perez de Alderete, two of the four non-spec team members who won first place at the American Society for Mechanical Engineers' 8th annual iShow late last month. At least 118 people have been killed in twin blasts in the Nigerian city of Jos. Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan blamed the terrorist group Boko Haram for the attacks. The government is already dealing with a national crisis over the nearly 300 schoolgirls abducted by Boko Haram weeks ago.
The U.S. military is sharing intelligence with Nigeria in the search for Boko Haram's leaders and the kidnapped girls. Here's Pentagon spokesman Rear Admiral John Kirby.
People have, you know, said it's a needle in a haystack. It's a needle in a jungle. I mean, we're talking about an area roughly the size of West Virginia, and it's dense forest jungle.
You can hear the chanting there, "Bring back our girls." That's the sound of protesters outside the Nigerian embassy in Belgium, angrily urging the government of Nigeria to do more to fight Boko Haram. As many Nigerians have said on this program, there is a deep frustration with Nigerian authorities right now. One writer told us Nigeria will always find a way to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory, a reminder that for all the country's problems, it is one of the fastest-growing economies in the world, the number one economy in Africa. With the rise of its energy businesses, media and tech sector, and a popular film industry, has also come extraordinary corruption and the violence of Boko Haram. Rana Faruhar is assistant managing editor for economics at Time Magazine and witnessed the perilous contradictions in Nigeria at the recent World Economic Forum in Abuja, which convened just as the kidnapping story was unfolding in front of a shocked world. Welcome, Rana.
Thank you.
So what an amazing seat to have observed what's going on both deeply in the Nigerian economy and in this spectacle that was unfolding for the whole world.
Yeah, it was fascinating to be there. And, you know, the two issues are really interlinked because I was at the World Economic Forum. There are investors from Africa, from all over the world there. And they're looking at what's happening with Boko Haram. They're looking at the incredible international attention to this issue, and they're thinking, okay, this is an economy that's growing 7 or 8%, but is there any security here? You know, are our investments safe here? So the issues became interlinked, and the girls really overshadowed the entire conference, I would say.
So who's making money in Nigeria, and why? And is that a lesson for investors or not?
Well, it's interesting. I have to say, I've been to a lot of developing countries. I have never seen an economy that's more dysfunctional in terms of the level of corruption, the amount of bribery, the amount of dysfunction at every level, really. I mean, just to give you a small example, I walk into my Radisson Hotel. There's a giant sign at the reception check-in that says, "Money laundering not allowed in this hotel." You know, so that's like the baseline.
And at the airport, there's a brisk trade in bags to stuff cash in, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, you know, giant bags of cash. I was wearing a $4,000 money
belt.
Money belt, right. Exactly. And you know, you're having to pay in cash all the time, which makes the black market economy just thrive. And that's everywhere. The other thing it's just a real tension. There's incredible entrepreneurialism. But because there's so much public dysfunction, you know, you don't have a proper working grid system. People are responsible for their own water sanitation, their own sewage. Individuals are responsible for actually fixing the roads, which is why it's a disaster to travel in Nigeria. You know, I think the economy could actually grow in a much more sustainable way if the government was even a little more functional.
So in daily life, you encounter experiences where you have no faith that the civic authorities will do anything for you. When you turn on the water, when you look at the roads,
yeah,
there's just do it yourself or forget about it.
Total DIY. And it's interesting, actually. I was in Lagos doing a piece for part of my time on the Nigerian film business, which is by output the second largest in the world after Bollywood, the Indian film business. And I interviewed a small filmmaker who was trying to run an entire film project with his home generator, right, because there's no national grid system. In the middle of the project, someone steals his generator. He has to go buy another one. That one gets stolen. He, you know, you'd think he could call the police and they would come. Well, no, the police often don't get paid. So you have to pay local vigilantes to go and actually, you know, find your generator, figure out what's going on. It's just an incredible system.
Sounds like a script for a Nigerian movie right there.
So,
exactly.
A
storyline.
So,
if there are rich people in Lagos, where do they put their money?
Well, a lot of them put it in energy, of course. But it's interesting. The World Bank actually recently recalculated the country's GDP figures. And the entertainment business, the services businesses, the telecoms business, the mobile business is actually thriving in this country. And one of the reasons for that is because of the poor infrastructure, because a lot of African nations never really had proper fixed-line phones. They've kind of jumped. And so everybody has a cell phone. And there's an incredible economy in mobile app development. They've done a lot with mobile banking. I met a couple of people that are digitizing the entertainment business and putting it online. So that's a big area as well.
Can the government be involved in that? Is there a development strategy that bypasses the government and would give money directly to the entrepreneurs, or what?
Well, it's interesting. So far, it's been very much a sort of self-funded, you know, people's families pitch in to fund small businesses kind of economy. The government has privatized the telecoms industry, which did help a lot. If they privatized power, I think that that would help too, because you'd get a little more competition. And literally, if people could just keep the lights on for 24 hours in this country, I think that they could do a lot.
Is Boko Haram and the violence that we've seen a threat to any possibility of development and investment in Nigeria?
So it's interesting. I was asking that of all the investors I met, particularly the big Western blue chips, because there's a lot of them coming in, like Walmart, Procter & Gamble, GE. I actually spoke with the vice chair of GE, who said he was concerned about it, not so much because this is going to affect their particular operations, but what it says about the priorities of development in this country. So there's a lot of connection between whether a country develops and becomes wealthier and whether they can keep girls and women in education and support female empowerment. And so from that standpoint, if you say this country is not all that worried about the safety of its women, that's problematic for business development.
So to a person on the street in Lagos, what would be more meaningful to them? Capturing the Boko Haram leaders, making safe passage for girls in schools, or fixing the roads?
That's a good question. I would actually say power. You know, I would say people spend about 40% of their take-home income on generators and diesel fuel because there is no working grid system. And this is a country that has exported over $1 trillion of oil wealth. You know, there's no reason for it.
Oil rich. Rana Fruhar is assistant managing editor in charge of economics and business for Time Magazine. Thanks.
Thank you.
Jealousy can come up in any marriage, in any relationship, but when you're not in the same physical space, you don't know who the other potential, you know, flirting people are.
Hello.
So that's something they talk about.
That's Anna Sale, host of the new podcast, Death, Sex, and Money. Coming up, some thoughts about long-distance couples and their challenges. They really opened up to Anna Sale. We want you to open up to us. Long-distance marriages and relationships, do they work? We'd love to hear from you at 877-8-MY-TAKE or find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
You're so far away. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Mike Steele from Austin, Texas. Yes, I've had a long-distance relationship, and no, it didn't work out. I think the killer was the lack of sharing of our everyday experiences. Explicitly telling someone about them isn't the same as sharing them moment to moment, of course.
The poignant truth about long-distance relationships. They are hard.
Why are you so far away from me?
This is Gil from St. Louis, Missouri. My wife was living in Indianapolis, Indiana, and I in Fayetteville, North Carolina when we met. This lasted for 2 years, and then I moved to Germany, and she joined me 5 months later. We talked on the phone every day while I was in the States, and once per week when we were separated by the Atlantic Ocean. 23 years later, our relationship is still working because we love and trust each other implicitly.
If you have a story to add to Gil and Mike there, we'd love to hear it. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post a comment at thetakeaway.org. Interesting, only guys speaking there. Do guys get the better end of the long-distance deal? We know there are a lot more stories out there. It's estimated that more than 3.5 million couples in the U.S. live apart in what are being called commuter marriages. That's double since 1990, and it doesn't even count the old-fashioned long-distance unmarried relationships. Anna Sale, host of Death, Sex, and Money, tackles this issue in her latest podcast episode. Anna, welcome.
Hi, John.
So you look at a special case, musicians who live on the road.
That's
ouch.
Right.
That's right. Yes, I talked to Jason Isbell and Amanda Shires. They're husband and wife. They live in Nashville when they're not on the road. Jason just put out a solo album last year called Southeastern that was a big hit before he played with Drive-By Truckers, the Southern rock band. Amanda Shires plays fiddle and writes and sings on her own. So they are sometimes touring together, but often touring apart, particularly now since Jason's career's blown up a little bit.
And how tough is it for them?
Well, that was one of the things that I didn't expect when talking to them was how relatable it was to hear the ways, what their challenges are with being on the road. Listen to how they talk about talking on the phone and how they check in.
I'm bad at it. I have modes, you know, mental modes that I get in. And when I'm on the road, part of me just gets switched off, you know, the part that's very private and very personal and very intimate. That especially, that part of me gets shut off. So I've been trying really hard in the last few months to call that part back up when we're checking in with each other, when we're on the phone, to actually, because she feels like she's talking to a robot sometimes, and I understand that.
It's more like a list conversation rather than a conversation.
It's tough. I mean, you have to be guarded. And then, of course, you know, every night he's out there and everyone's, you know, worshiping him, fawning all over him, right?
Well, that's the other thing they talked about. I mean, jealousy can come up in any marriage, in any relationship. But when you're not in the same physical space, you don't know who the other potential, you know, flirting people are.
Hello.
So that's something they talk about.
I think in my mind, you know, I sometimes just ask them or say, you know, have you been talking to any women? Then some days I'm like, whatever he does, I have no control over his actions. And whatever he does or does not do, it's not a reflection on me, you know. It's the choices he makes.
We don't ignore it, you know. The fact that there are other people vying for our attention and that you know, when you're on the road, it makes it easier to think you can get away with stuff like that. We discuss it, you know. If somebody's worried, we talk about it. And, you know, usually if you name something, it becomes a lot less difficult to defeat.
Right.
So were you buying this when you were with them? I mean, they talk seemingly very intimately, but did you get a sense of whether they're stressing as a result of this, or are they pulling together?
Well, I got the sense that it's an everyday stress, but you heard there, this is how we figured out how to deal with it. Amanda says, you know, sometimes I just say I have limited control here and I just have to trust him. And then they also, you know, have figured out how to talk about it, that when they feel threatened or afraid, they're just going to say, what's happening on the road? Who are you talking to?
So you think they're going to make it? Did you ask him that point blank?
I think they did say, they said, look, we're doing the best we can. And when you choose a partner that you trust, that's the best you can do. And if you're a grown up, if your heart gets stomped on, you'll survive.
How different do you think it is between relationships that are, the expectations are, well, we'll see where this goes, and it's long distance, which is probably the more common notion of a long distance relationship, versus we're together for life and we got to go through this difficult period for a few years?
Well, I think that's what I was interested to find out looking at the statistics of increasing long distance marriages. But from the limited studies there have been, it doesn't look like it's actually more of a predictor of divorce or separation. So, you know, maybe saying that commitment, we're a lifelong commitment, this is what we're doing and this is why we're apart. You know, this doesn't just affect high-income musicians. This affects people who have to be separate for economic reasons. Maybe the wife has to go, you know, a couple states over to get a job because there aren't opportunities, you know, at home.
Back in the 60s, my dad worked for IBM, you know, and they relocated him, you know, every other year. And we spent 1 year with my dad in Syracuse, and we were in Binghamton, New York. And my mother really describes that as a devastating time. I mean, they weren't going to break up, but it was very stressful.
It's difficult. One of the things that Jason and Amanda talked about, though, that I liked was I asked him, what do you do when your partner's not there? And Jason immediately said, I eat barbecue. She doesn't like barbecue. That's what I do. I get to listen to Steely Dan when she's not there. So that's the other flip side of having a little time apart from your husband or wife. You get to have a little me time.
Does FaceTime enter in here? I mean, this technology, I find that it's more painful sometimes to do the face-to-face hookup, even as great as it is. It's really fantastic for the kids to see mom when she's out of town. But I'm wondering if technology helps or hurts here.
Well, as most things with technology, it's both. You could look at your partner 3,000 miles away. But the other thing that Amanda and Jason brought up that I hadn't really thought about was the other side of technology is there's so many other ways that other people can contact you without your partner having a sense of it, you know, whether it's a text or an email. That's something that has been something they've had to talk about is what's happening on your phone while you're on the road as well.
Everybody talks about that now. Yeah. I mean, it's the toxic waste of American relationships, is the digital technology.
Well, Jason said, he said there's so many country music songs about, you know, a wife picking up the phone and nobody calling and nobody being on the other end. And he's like, there aren't those songs anymore because we all have so many other ways to reach each other.
I have a marriage counselor who used to say that in the last 10 years, his entire business has become dealing with phone message issues and text and Facebook message issues.
Huh.
It's gone from never to that's all he does.
That's the practice. That's interesting.
Well, how about you?
It's something I've thought about a lot because my boyfriend is often in the field as an ecologist. And so, you know, with FaceTime, there's sometimes you can trick yourself into feeling like you can still feel like you're in each other's daily lives. But when you're in very different places, it is different. And so then the calculation is, how often do we need to see each other to feel like we're connected? For Jason and Amanda, they said they just feel like every 3 weeks they have to make sure they see each other. There's some kind of visit. And that wasn't scientific. That was mostly from surveying other musicians in Nashville to see what they were told about the ways to have a healthy relationship. And the 3 week rule seemed to be something they were taught.
And if you need to talk about your long distance relationship, you can talk to Anna Sale.
That's what we're learning in this podcast.
Anyone can talk to Anna Sale, host of the new podcast, Death, Sex, and Money. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Regards to long distance relationships, I'm in one, and he's somewhere in a ship serving with a cruise industry, and I work for the same company when I was on a ship. Unfortunately, we're not together, but still keep it rocking with the waves.
That's Kelly there sharing more of your thoughts on long distance relationships. She's in Miami, Florida. She called us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. If you want to tell us a story about missing somebody, picking up the phone, we'd love to hear it. Check us out at takeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TiVo. Recording up to 6 shows at once and 3,000 hours, plus Netflix, Hulu Plus, and YouTube. All on the TiVo Romeo DVR. TiVo.com.